This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Jason Whitehead joins us in studio, star local reporter. Most of your work we see in the Seville Weekly as of late, and you did have a fantastic cover story recently about poverty in Charlottesville. But before we get to that, you were the guy that dug up the big story about the Enjek land deal, and it was reported on back when it happened in May of 2006, but you were the one that sort of really started turning the rocks over and saying, well, what really happened? And a fascinating story that we've talked about quite a bit on this program. What's the very latest? You know, can you? I know that you haven't really written much about it lately, but I know you continue to follow it.
Well, I know from just reading about it that there was a recent planning commission meeting where Winnowood was trying to get approval of various facilities he wanted to build right across from Enjek, where he would house contractors and also have office space. And I know that was that's meant to be on a separate part of land than the 30 acres that he got approved. But I know he has,
or
I'm pretty sure
suggested that it be approved,
right?
Not approved, yeah,
right,
yeah.
That. I think he has similar plans for that land as well, but I guess it was a pretty contentious meeting. So,
yeah, you weren't there, but it sounded like it was contentious with gavels slamming, and
but it sounded like just since I've been covering this and talking with Winnowood at various points, not too atypical of a scenario. I mean, him getting kind of blustery and kind of trying to push things one way, and then a few members of a board kind of pulling back the other way. So it seems like almost a dance in a sense, because he gets some of what he wants and they get some of what they want, and they kind of always end up meeting in the middle. And
yeah,
but there's a lot of theatrics that go on during all of it. So
yeah. Jason Whitehead is our guest. What is your, now you've had a lot of time to think about this whole story, a lot of time to digest it. You've heard a lot of the public discussion about it. There's a lot of people out there, and I still get emails and phone calls from people who would love nothing more than for me to get up and talk about this every day. I'm not going to, because that's not the kind of show that I'm trying to do, but a lot of people are still very upset about it. There's some people out there that would love for me not to talk about this at all. And they have made themselves known to me, would love for me just not to bring this up and not to bring any attention to it whatsoever. It seems to be an issue that really strikes a chord with a lot of people.
Yeah, I think what's interesting about it, just giving it some perspective, like 6 months now writing about it, is the degree to which I think everybody involved has their own motives, and it's easy to kind of get caught up in making Winnowood look like a villain. Like, I think it's important to keep everything in context, and even in a national context, you know, I think this is something that's quite common around America. Like, a military facility moves in a community, there's a lot of changes in general how the military, even the government, conducts its business usually, you know. Like, I think that's something that hasn't really been given a lot of focus, but how even the military's conducted itself in this process. And I think it's a general, you know, the military, I think, has this opinion of themselves, and it may be right, but that, you know, we're out putting our lives on the line, you should always accommodate us. And that's kind of like just this, you know, it can be a problem for a community, I think, when they come in it, because they just kind of insert themselves and they'll be like, yeah, we give these benefits, we buy houses, we improve, you know, the value of your markets, and we're on school boards and stuff like that. But they do just kind of come in your community. They're there, and like in ours now, infinite expansion, and it's having all these ripple effects now. So,
and the expansion, of course, we're talking locally about the National Ground Intelligence Center, which has since moved out of Charlottesville, is up 29 and is going to expand. That's a done deal, the expansion, right? I mean, we're talking about 1,000 families, 1,000 jobs that are going to be relocated. It's not 1,000 new jobs here for local folks. It's 1,000 jobs that are being transplanted from elsewhere to Albemarle County as a part of Enjek's expansion.
Right. And that's one thing I think that's like really interesting about this most recent development in Wendell trying to build hotels and offices right across from it is he spoke of it as being kind of this all-inclusive thing. Because I think one of the interesting things about it is they're asking him to do these proffers that are over $1 million, and that's what he was really upset about.
Yeah, he didn't want to do that.
Right, which is understandable. And from talking to him a few times, that's something that really does stick in his craw, apparently, like he would continually bring up, like, you know, before I could even build over here, I had to put in the road. Or he always talks about how before NGIC was approved, they require that he build that Boulder Highway road right there. So he always feels, this seems quite consistent, everything he says, that he's very burdened, that the county's always putting these kind of requirements on him. So then he's pushing against that.
Yeah. And that's certainly not unique to him. I mean, talk to any developer anywhere. They always feel like, you know, and you know what? I'm not a developer. They could be right. I don't know. But they always feel like there's so many hoops that they have to jump to just do their job, which is to develop. But at the end of the day, this is somebody's job that has such an incredible impact on the wider community.
Right.
So I'm one of those folks that, to me, it makes sense to have a real process to it where a lot of people can be involved, and that hopefully you have a very open process, a very public process, which is why I'm not a fan of those daisy chain meetings that they have, where you have, you know, if you have three boards of supervisors at a meeting, it has to be public. So they'll have just two. Therefore, they don't have to have a public meeting, and they'll do two, one after another, two, and therefore it's never public. And I've it's no secret I'm not a fan of that. It's legal, but I'm not a fan of it. I just don't think that that is true in the spirit of an open government. But
well, one thing that's been interesting working on this story is the degree to which private citizens have picked up aspects of this. And one is I know one citizen who was just looking into it. When I first worked on the story, I was under the impression that most of, like, Ken Boyd and the board learning that they might lose the NGIC facility, that they only had like a week or two to turn around their vote and reconsider and everything. And a citizen has uncovered that it was actually much longer of a process, which is also interesting in light of those 2x2 meetings, because if they had a much longer time to consider this, which I think they had, it began like at the beginning of March, so they had like a much longer time than I'd previously thought, then there should have been time to make this a little more public or something of that element.
But. And of course, their response would be no decisions have been made. It's still public. There's still opportunities for the public to come forward and voice their concerns and share their pros and cons. And there'll be numerous meetings that will be scheduled, and we will certainly be making those, you know, letting folks know when they're going to be held, and before any final decision is made about this whole quote-unquote deal that was put together.
Right.
Really fascinating stuff. Let's continue our discussion with Jason Whitehead, local Star reporter. You had a cover story recently in the Seville Weekly that explored the world of poverty in our community, and it really... we'll talk about it in depth, but it really put a face on this situation. But before we do that, just some numbers. What's the percentage of poverty in Charlottesville and Albemarle County?
A quarter of Charlottesville is below the poverty at or below the poverty line, and then 20% throughout the country. So,
20. You mean the fifth, county?
Yeah, sorry, through the county. So, 20 to 25% of the whole area.
So one out of five families basically in the county is at or below the poverty line, and one out of four in the city, 25%.
Yeah, so yeah, it's pretty broad,
and that poverty line is set by the federal levels. You know, that's pretty generous anyway. I mean, the truth is it could be a lot higher than that. That line could be higher and still would include a lot of the working poor.
Yeah, and it's a, you know, it's always a shifting thing as well, depending on how the area is fluctuating this way or that.
Yeah. So now where are you sitting? What's going on where you realize, you know, I'm going to go do a story about poverty? What's going on? Why'd you do that?
Well, the first thing that really piqued my interest in it was just one day on the downtown mall, I met this or talked to this busker who I just was like, how
do you know? You talked to a what?
A busker, a guy who plays his guitar on the mall.
That's called a busker?
Yeah.
I've never heard that.
It's an old like, British word or English word. But and, you know, just puts his hat or a bucket out there and collects money. And I started talking to him and, you know, was like, how do you make money to live on, you know, because he had like $5 in his hat or whatever. And he started talking about how he goes to this place called Labor Ready and how he had to show up there at 5:30 in the morning and you know, work all day, all these odd jobs. And then like a week later, I ran into him and was like, oh, how's your work been going? And he was like, oh, man, the last 2 days I've been doing Labor Ready, and I got there at 5:30, was out on this farm by like 7:30 in the morning, work all day baling hay with a 30-minute lunch break. That's it. And had done that 2 straight days and like pulled up his shirt and his arms were all slit with, you know, like the ends of hay and stuff. And you're like, that's kind of a crazy existence. And then started looking into that and just, you know, started thinking more because you just hear about you know, illegal immigration all the time and, you know, that Americans don't want to do these low-level jobs and, you know, just all those different elements of our area. And just, you know, there's a number of public housing sites in our area, like 7 of them. That seems large to me. I don't know if it is, but for...
Well, 25% of the people in the city of Charlottesville at or below the poverty line, when you know the poverty line is set pretty low already... that's staggering. I mean, that really is amazing. But this is, we were talking during the break, this is talking about poverty can be very difficult in the media today because you stand the chance of losing people right at the beginning. When you say, let's talk about poverty, you know, snooze, I don't want to hear about that. I got other things going on.
Well, that's one thing.
You know, people say the poor have always been with us. They're always going to be with us. What can you do?
Right. And there are a number of elements with like that. Like I do kind of feel like there's a disdain for the poor by your just, you know, average person. Probably I'm even guilty of that or you're guilty of that, you know, where sometimes you're just like, why don't these people just go get a job? You know, like they're hiring at McDonald's or Pizza Hut like that. So there's like this disdain element. And then there, I mean, one thing that really, I think, pertains to our community is it seems to be such an affluent community. Like, you can go to the Paramount and you can, you know, see this sort of like Sound of Music from whenever. Yeah. Or you can go for a concert at Ashlawn or you can go for a wine festival on the weekend. And then you have like right next to like, say, Hamilton's on the downtown mall, you have like this busker who's making $5. You know, like there's this... A millionaire is walking past the guy who only makes $6 a day or something.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
That kind of
which it can
inequity.
Be rare for a community this size to see that disparity. But we do have that disparity here. There are very, very wealthy people who live in and around Charlottesville. And there's also a whole lot of poor people who work and don't work.
And then you have like public housing is literally what? Like 500 feet from X where you pay like $20 for a martini or something. You know, like you just have really like these real odd disparities that really clash up in our community.
Yeah, we have the Charlottesville, the city really it could be on a path to being like Old Town Alexandria where you have Section 8 housing literally across the street from million-dollar townhomes.
Yeah, so it's not something that's unique to our community at all. But and then you just have the this concept of the working poor, which I think has been like the media has picked up much more in recent years. But you even have like a guy now running for president that's his main platform. John Edwards is talking about, you know, poverty. But I just saw the other day a poll where they polled like people at or below the poverty line and they don't favor John Edwards as the candidate. So something's not communicating there. And I know there's been, you know, a lot of stuff to do with, you know, he's a multi-millionaire, and there's always that kind of thing, like, how can you talk about the poor when you live in a mansion or get...
Yeah, yeah.
Like, he had a big thing about his $400 haircut or whatever, and how can you talk about the poor? But it's still good that he's bringing it up.
Well, that's one of the great losses, of the many great losses that we faced as a country when Martin Luther King was assassinated because, you know, he was getting ready to do the March on Washington, and he had sort of not transitioned, but his movement had grown from talking about race to talking about poverty. And it never really flowered under his leadership to the point where he was really leading a national conversation about poverty. But that's where he was going.
Yeah.
Before, when he was killed, that's where he was going. He wanted to talk more and more about, you know, I don't care what color you are. You know, let's not talk about the left and the right. It's about the up and the down here.
Yeah.
It's about those who have and those who don't.
One guy who tried to keep that going was Jesse Jackson, I guess, to an extent. I guess he was a protege of King.
Yeah, yeah.
But that was one of the things I was surprised is I just remembered him vaguely speaking about the poor from my past, but went back and looked at his speech and the speech he gave at the 88 Democrat convention about how America, like, that was its great ill, and we needed to solve, you know, this conundrum of the poor.
Let's continue our conversation with Jason Whitehead, recently the author of a cover story in the SEVA Weekly regarding poverty in our area. You went to this labor-ready place where a lot of the working poor in our community go to, like, I guess instead of standing around the 7-Eleven parking lot waiting for a truck to pull in, with day work, they go to this place called Labor Ready. Is that it?
Right. You show up at Labor Ready, and it's a national service. They also supply, I think, England, Canada. But you go to this Labor Ready place between 5:30 and 6 a.m. And
there's a 5:30 a.m. now?
Yeah. It was early. I mean, it was hard. And you sit there, and there's a couple employees there, and they represent – it seemed to be mostly construction and that sort of work, but you come there and...
Where is it?
It's right on Main Street. It was right next to Star Hill.
Okay.
And very close to Mel's Cafe, like right in the middle of
those.
Was
it crowded?
Yeah. There were, I would say, about 40 people in there. And just as the morning progressed, they kept being sent out on different day jobs. And I guess the attraction of a place like that, say for transients, for one thing, you get paid at the end of every day, and so also if you need, like, quick money, so the fact that you get paid at the end of every day is a real attraction. And even if you're hard up for money, like say you're under the poverty line, you'd rather not get paid twice a month or once a month, but get paid at the end of every day so you can keep meeting your daily cost of living.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I went out on a construction crew with...
Did they ask you, like, you had to prove that you were poor, or was there anything like that? Or you just put your name on a list?
No, I mean, I could easily just go do it.
So
right,
anybody
now
can go in there.
You just had to take this sort of odd personality test and then get...
You had to take a personality test?
Well, they had all these kind of questions like, you know, do you like to steal when you're at your employer's? Or, you know, really? Or do you, you know, what kind of drugs do you use? And do you like to use drugs while you're at work? And do you like to start fights with people? Questions like that.
Yeah. So, I guess are sensible questions.
Yeah.
If you're sending somebody out to work. Yeah.
But it was pretty much just routine construction labor. Like, I guess.
Where'd you go? Was there a bus or somebody come in a truck?
That was one interesting thing about Labor Ready is that they only had a couple employees. And because a lot of people, I guess, don't have transportation that are doing Labor Ready, they end up having to cart everybody to their job and then bring them back home, which gets kind of complicated because since they only have one or two people working there, it's hard to be at the sites when you get off, which is kind of a bad thing about Labor Ready, or I guess it can be. But it was just, you know, like your average construction thing. The thing that was kind of notable about it, and I've done construction before, is just that it is like a hard, taxing work, though, in the sense of, like, you can be standing out in the sun for 12 hours and, you know, half of construction is kind of just standing around or somebody going, pick that up off the ground, and you pick up a toilet seat off the ground or whatever, you know, like it's but it was pretty exhausting.
It can be physically demanding. You're not sitting at a computer all day in air conditioning.
And I think that's what you would find about a lot of these jobs, because, like, also, like, worked in a kitchen for like half of a shift, and even that was just exhausting, being there for like 3 hours, you know, like 10 ovens all open just blasting.
Is that another Labor Ready thing you did?
No, this was just when I first started working on the story, I actually had the idea of that I would try to do like six or seven different type of jobs, but got like two jobs into it and was like, this is going to be the same story over and over again. Like whether I'm, you know, a maid cleaning a bed in a hotel or working in a restaurant or doing construction, like it's going to be very much the same story. So I shifted into then I ended up talking to like a lot of these people who run soup kitchens around here food pantries and, you know, just try to help the poor a lot. And that ended up becoming the focus of my story.
And we were talking during
reaffirming.
We were talking during the break. Jason Whitehead is my guest. There are a lot of things like that in our community. Thank goodness when we got, you know, a quarter of the population in poverty. There are a lot of organizations and services that are available. Hopefully, that would be able to give them a ladder to get out of that hole.
Yeah.
Which to me personally, that would be the goal. You give them a means by which to get out of poverty, get educated, and steadily get better paying jobs, and put them on a progression towards where they would hopefully want to be, rather than being stuck pushing a broom for their whole life.
Right, and that is there's, and working on this article, I found that there were two ways of trying to attack the issue of poverty. One was sort of like what they would call the Band-Aid, which is like the shelters that give homeless a place to stay, or the soup kitchens, you know, that operate like 5 days a week. And then you have the groups that are focused on more long-term results, like extending, say, bus routes throughout the county, so not so much money, you know, so somebody doesn't have to, you know, take a taxi to work or whatever, and just making it easier to try to break out of, you know, the cycle of poverty. And so
any other big things you walked away with from that experience, besides the fact that I'm sure you're glad you don't have to go to Labor Ready every morning at 5:30?
Right. I mean, that was the one way I got through that Labor Ready, was that I was only doing it for one day. But I guess what I took away from it is you do have a lot of these places like Salvation Army and various churches that are doing soup kitchens and or giving away food. Like, they're all very taxed for any type of support. Like, they all need volunteers. They all, like, one guy with, like, this one food pantry told me, like, $10 buys a pound and a half of food. So there's real easy ways to help out that way, or just, you know, just even volunteering at the Salvation Army. And then there's these groups like called Impact and so forth that are trying to, you know, make actual changes in people's lives, that sort of thing. So.
Jason Whitehead, local reporter. His recent cover story is in the Seville Weekly about poverty in our area. Thank you, Jason. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SeavillePodcast.com for more.